Oliver Samard.
And I'm Jessica Vosk, and this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer. And hello, Julia Murney. Oh, my.
J-cubed.
I didn't even think about it until we were
wow.
saying our names.
Well, you know, should Julia, you not only are you smart as a tack, but, you know, we, the J&J, not vaccine, just the Jen and Jess, are very thrilled to have you here with us on the KIOB podcast, as I'm sure all of our listeners are as well. Now, all of our listeners do know that you are the truest of Broadway stars, television stars. You are a fabulous dog mom. The list goes on and on. We can talk all day about it. And even though you do have an amazing career, we don't want to talk about it at all today.
Because so what? Who cares?
Hey, so what? Who cares?
You know, lots of people care. Lots of people care. But we actor types, don't we live to talk about other things?
We do. Sometimes. I mean, otherwise we are narcissists. Sometimes.
Right. Yeah.
We're dramatic.
Listeners, this is Jen, and I'm sorry if I sound a little different. I'm not in my usual pod space. I am filming a movie, but I'm talking about my career, and we don't do that here. But I'm not in my normal space, so I'm so sorry. So if I sound funny, that's why. But Julia, in addition to your many, many accomplishments, we're going to get right to it today. We have a lot to cover, and we'd like to ask our guests a couple of questions, okay?
I'm still not over pod space, by the way.
My pods. Is that what you call it?
I have a vision of you like in a physical pod.
Every time people see a picture of it, it does look like that, right?
Because that's what everybody's like Dungeons and Dragons.
There's a place in London where I've gone for high tea called Sketch, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. And the bathrooms are these actual like pods that you get into and the toilet is in there. And anyway, that's all I can envision. I interrupted you, Jenna.
I love it. We love interruption here. Interruption station. We love it. But getting back to these questions that we know our killer listeners are dying to know the answer to, we want to know, Ms. Murney, why are you interested in true crime? And yes, we may have seen you on a few episodes of Law and Order. What of it? And if you are interested, why do you believe we dramatic actor types, you know, kind of live for it?
Well, I will say to the Law and Order tip, I've been very disappointed to, as of yet, not have played a killer, which is sort of a bummer.
Putting it out there, Warren.
Your victim.
I will say my son did very bad things.
Oh,
very bad things. Mm-hmm. But partially because I was a very bad mother and married a very bad man. So
wow,
yeah. But okay. On CI, I played one where they tried to like set it up like it could be any of the people who live in the condo, kind of a thing. But I was like, it's clear who it is. It's the guy you recognize from Saving Private Ryan. It's the most famous person on the episode. They get to be the killer.
Oh, right. Man. So, this is a lot to unpack.
Yes, but Reed Burney played my husband on that one. So we were the Bernie Murneys. Yeah, it was awesome.
Cute.
Anyway, I definitely do enjoy a true crime situation on my cable TV. I often think to myself, this is not the wisest move as a single lady girl here in the big city, just watching this by myself in the apartment, is probably not wise.
Julia, you and I have probably discussed ad nauseum the amount of times that we've watched Forensic Files or ID or The Oxygen Network or like, you know, obviously Wives with Knives. But today, the case we are discussing happened to take place. And I know that you're like, oh my God, a ladybird in the heart of Manhattan watching true crime. But this one did particularly take place in Manhattan on the Upper West Side. There are memorials to this day right over hop, skip and a jump in Central Park. And to be sure that we are correct here, you are a born and raised Manhattanite. Is this correct?
I was not born, but raised from the age of 4 and a half. So
okay,
you could certainly say
get out
from here.
Okay, we're going to say that you are from 4 and a half, I think those are some formative years. So we're going to call you a Manhattanite.
Yes.
So that's what you need to know, killers.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of like Jess, how you wanted to do the case of Susan Powell from the beginning. I've been wanting to do this case from the beginning because I was 10 years old when it happened. I'll talk about what it meant to me more later. But Julia, we have wanted to have you on. I just know as an Upper West Sider who was blocks from where this happened, you were a young girl when this happened. So I can't wait to get into it with you.
It's true. my memories of it are sort of flashpoint, very specific.
All right.
Ooh.
Very, very
specific.
Ooh. Well, killers, let's get into it. But before we take you on another one of these journeys, you know we must give credit where credit is due. We got some of our info today from our beloved Wikipedia. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the murder of John Lennon. Before we take a dive into this particular crime, we assume most, if not all of you, are aware of who John Lennon was, but if you're just learning about him today, lucky you. And here are some cliff notes. John Winston Ono Lennon, born John Winston Lennon, on October 9th, 1940, was an English singer, songwriter, musician, and peace activist who achieved worldwide fame as the founder, co-lead vocalist, and rhythm guitarist of The Beatles. His songwriting partnership with Paul McCartney remains the most successful in music history. Despite a difficult childhood marked heavily by the death of his mother, Julia, Lennon managed to skyrocket to fame over his adult years and really leaning into activism toward the later part of his life. The murder of John Lennon has remained one of the most publicly remembered moments in pop culture. The fact that it was a premeditated murder by an American fan remains out of this world and truly really scary to any of the, I mean, to anyone, but also those of us in showbiz. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to contemplate. The killer was a man by the name of Mark David Chapman, who was 25 years old. Now, let's sprinkle in a bit of who Mark is, shall we? Raised in Decatur, Georgia, Chapman had been a fan of the Beatles, but was incensed by Lennon's lifestyle and public statements, such as his remark about the Beatles being, quote, more popular than Jesus, end quote, and the lyrics of his later songs In God and Imagine. In the years leading up to the murder, Chapman developed a series of obsessions, including artwork and the music of Todd Rundgren. The Catcher in the Rye took on a great personal significance for him to the extent that he wished to model his life after the novel's protagonist, Holden Caulfield. Chapman also contemplated killing other public figures, including right. Johnny Carson. Yeah. This is like a red flag. If not John Lennon, he was going to perhaps kill Johnny Carson or Paul McCartney or Ronald Reagan. He had no prior criminal convictions and had just resigned from a job as a security guard in Hawaii. I mean, he's no Magnum PI. That seems like a very bold move, Mark. But there you have it, Jess.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, first of all, John Lennon's mother's name was Julia. It is no mistake that we have a Julia on the podcast today. I'm just saying, number two.
Well, it is also no mistake that I was named after John Lennon's mother.
I knew it. I effing knew it.
John Lennon has been with me from the day I was born.
Ma'am?
Because.
Say it.
When I was a bébé in vitro.
That's French for in vitro.
Uh-huh. My dad had this, awesome plan that if I was a boy, he wanted to name me Rock. So my name would be Rock Murney, or he wanted to name me Murney. So my name would be Murney Murney.
Oh boy. Okay. Dad.
Because my dad was high. Exactly. And but while my mom was pregnant, the White Album came out by the Beatles. P.S. If anyone here is listening and was like, I didn't know who John Lennon was, I don't want to shame you. But I want to shame you. So
you heard it first.
Please,
you heard it first. She's upset.
Just go and check who the Beatles are and understand that all music that came after it came from there. Okay.
Okay. Listen, Julia Rock, Murney Murney.
Just saying. So the White Album came out, and on the White Album, there is a cut that John wrote for his mother, Julia, who was killed when he was, I can't recall, 14 or 15.
He
years
was
old.
14.
Yeah. She was, they lived in England, and she was actually waiting for the bus, and she was hit.
That's right.
By a drunk off-duty police officer. And he was brought up by his Aunt Mimi, sidebar. No. And he wrote this beautiful song about his mom, Julia. And it is a cut on the White Album, which came out while my mom was pregnant. And my mom was like, ooh, I like that song. And that's how I got my name.
And that song begins with half of what I say is meaningless. And that was my audition for the play called Julia. Julia, now, boy, does this bring it all together. And now that we're talking about the killer of, because we like to give a background on everything when it comes to this podcast, it would be wrong to not talk about the issues with his killer. And so, it turns out that Chapman here allegedly started planning to kill John Lennon 3 months prior. to his murder. So he was a longtime fan of Lennon's band, the Beatles, and he turned against Lennon following a religious conversion. And as Jen mentioned, he was angry about Lennon's highly publicized 1966 comment that the Beatles were, quote, more popular than Jesus. Now, Jan Reeves, who's the sister of one of Chapman's friends, reported that Chapman, quote, seemed really angry toward Lennon and spoke frequently about Lennon's claim, saying it was blasphemy. And some members of Chapman's prayer group made a joke in reference to Lennon's song, Imagine. The joke went, imagine if John Lennon was dead. So that's fun. And Chapman's childhood friend, Miles, this is a fun name, but Chapman's childhood friend, Miles McManish, recalled that he said that the song was, quote, communist. So all righty then. Isn't it like, oh, and now what would they think of the songs of today? But anyway, he also recalled having listened to Lennon's solo albums in the weeks before the murder. And here's a quote. It says, quote, I would listen to this music and I would get angry at him for saying in the song God that he didn't believe in God and that he just believed in him and Yoko and that he didn't believe in the Beatles. This was another thing that angered me. Even though this record had been done at least 10 years previously, I just wanted to scream out loud, who does he think he is saying these things about God and heaven and the Beatles, saying that he doesn't believe in Jesus and things like that. At that point, my mind was going through a total blackness of anger and rage. So I brought the Lennon book home into this, the Catcher in the Rye milieu, where my mindset is Holden Caulfield and anti-phoniness. So, I mean, same. Should we all read The Catcher in the... Does everybody want to... Should we book group?
Well,
Oprah?
I think even more, you should look... If you look at the lyrics of God, of that song, the first line of that song is, God is a concept. That's going to piss some people off.
I surely think
it. He then goes on to list all these things he does not believe in, and... True to what you were just saying. I mean, I can't remember the lyrics precisely, but he says, like, I don't believe in I Ching. I don't believe in, like, he doesn't believe in other forms of religion. He says, I don't believe in Zimmerman, which means Bob Dylan. And the last one is, I don't believe in Beatles.
That's I just believe.
And then he says, I just believe in me, Yoko and me.
And
that was his jiggity jam.
You have to, it's what we were saying before, ladies, when we were offline about, if you don't like something I'm saying, you're free to unfollow me. You don't have to write me a big missive about it. You know, like there's this ownership, scary ownership quality to a fan like this that is really frightening.
Yeah. You know, you write it in your dear diary. Okay. But you know, he did not do that. And now it leads us to October of 1980. This is October of 1980, mind you, where Chapman decides he's going to go to New York intending to kill John Lennon, but left to obtain ammunition from his unwitting friend Dana Reeves in Atlanta before returning in November. And during his October trip to New York, Chapman was inspired by the film Ordinary People to stop his plans of killing Lennon. So he returns to Hawaii and tells his wife that he had been obsessed with killing Lennon. Chapman shows his wife the gun and the bullets, but she did not inform the police or mental health services. Chapman later said that the message, "Thou shalt not kill," flashed on the television at him and was on a wall hanging that his wife put up in their apartment. So he made an appointment to see a clinical psychologist at the time, but he did not keep it. And then he flew back to New York on December 6th. Of 1980, and at one point, Julia wants to say something, but let me just finish the sentence. Mm-hmm. He considered ending his own life by jumping from the Statue of Liberty, Julia.
I just want to point out how different the world was in the early 80s when this man went to Atlanta, got ammo for a gun, took that gun and ammo on an aeroplane back to Hawaii, and then back to New York, and without a skipperty diddle.
I know.
Just saying.
Remember the days where you didn't have to show ID to get on a bus?
Well, I also remember the days when you could, like, be so late for a plane that you're, like, running through and you just, like run through the metal detectors. You're like, I'm so sorry. And they're like, go. Like, I don't think a younger person would be able to understand what that was once.
Surely not. So now we get to December 7th, where, guess what? Chapman is in New York City. And he decides to accost the singer, James Taylor, at the 72nd Street subway station. Now, according to James Taylor, quote, the guy had sort of pinned me to the wall and was glistening with maniacal sweat and talking some freak speak about what he was going to do and his stuff with how John was interested and how he was going to get in touch with John Lennon, end quote. two things. I love the term freak speak. I'm using it for the rest of my life. And I would like to talk to James Taylor about this. So Chapman also reportedly offered cocaine to a taxi driver. And that night, Chapman and his wife talked on the phone about getting help with his problems by first working on his relationship with the big guy upstairs. You got it right. God.
I did not know that story about James Taylor. So he just came upon James Taylor on 72nd Street?
Yeah. Or, you know, you wonder if back then, you know, he knew where people lived, or if
I just, like, the amount of information that I know about Lennon, that part never came to me as surprising.
Well, and why you want to know what? That's why we have this podcast. We like to surprise you with
I will say, of the people that you listed before, you know, that Chapman had been considering trying to kill, John was easily the most accessible.
Sure.
He was very accessible for such an extraordinarily famous human.
Yes.
He was walking in Central Park. I saw him and Yoko from afar once, and I made up in my head that they came over and pet my dog. Fun fact, I don't think that actually happened, but I think I wanted it to happen, and I was like 9, so I made some shit up. But they were pretty known, even though where they lived was certainly like a relative fortress of security. But in terms of being out among the people, he wasn't the guy who, like, walked out, got in a car with his bodyguard, and nobody ever saw
him. For anybody who's watched the documentary, I can't remember which one it is, but it's a more recent documentary about John Lennon and his solo studio album. There was an entire filmed portion of him in his country home with Yoko, and a veteran, a war vet, he had been writing letters, and all he wanted to do was, like, have a conversation with John Lennon. And he had been suffering, you know, PTSD and very, very deep mental health issues, and showed up at his house, which these days you'd be like, who do I call to get this person out, because I'm now nervous? But he invited him in to have a conversation. I mean, this war vet had many issues with John, which he wanted to discuss his activism and his opinions. And John allowed it we feed you?
Right. John was very of the, what can we do?
Yes.
Let's discuss it. His music, especially in his later years, so accurately reflected how he felt about things. Mm. And, like, give peace a chance was not, like, he and Yoko deeply, especially with the advent of meeting Yoko, they deeply believed the stuff they espoused. It wasn't performative. It's not surprising to me at all that John would be the kind of person who would say to a stranger, perhaps not altogether stranger, who showed up at his door. And remember, you know, things were so different. Even we're talking, I guess, you know, 40 years ago. But things were so, not only was there no internet, there were no cell phones, there was no ADT security system. Like, things were just different.
God, we love that you just shouted out ADT. Jen, you must.
Sponsorship.
There were no dogs in 1980, you guys.
They did not have dogs until 1982. That's true.
Take us along, because we haven't even gotten to the big moment of what the crux of this is.
Yes. This is it. Well, this, as Jess says, this brings us to the fateful day of December 8th, 1980. Chapman left his room at the Sheridan Hotel, and he left personal items behind that he wanted the police to find. He bought a copy of The Catcher in the Rye, in which he wrote, quote, "This is my statement," signing it Holden Caulfield.
Oh, God.
He then spent most of the day near the entrance to the Dakota apartment building where Lennon lived, talking to fans and the doorman. Early in the morning, Chapman was distracted and missed seeing Lennon step out of a cab and enter the Dakota. Later in the morning, he met Lennon's housekeeper, who was returning from a walk with Lennon's 5-year-old son, Sean. Chapman reached in front of the housekeeper to shake Sean's hand, can you imagine, and said that he was a beautiful boy, quoting Lennon's song, Beautiful Boy. Get your hands off that child, sir. Wow. At approximately 5 p.m., Lennon and Ono left the Dakota for a recording session at Record Plant Studios. As they were walking to a limousine shared with the RKO radio crew, they were approached by Chapman. It was common for fans to wait outside the Dakota to meet Lennon and ask for his autograph. Lennon liked to oblige with autographs or pictures any fans who had been waiting for long periods of time to meet him. Chapman asked Lennon to sign a copy of his album, Double Fantasy. Chapman said, quote, he was very kind to me, ironically very kind, and was very patient with me. The limousine was waiting, and he took his time with me, and he got the pen going, and he signed my album. He asked me if I needed anything else. I said, no, no, sir. And he walked away. Very cordial and decent man, end quote.
Oh.
In 1992, Chapman said he felt Lennon knew there was something suspicious about him. Ugh, that is so narcissistic, isn't it?
Oh, my God. Well, can you imagine?
And haven't already figured out that he's narcissistic. I mean.
Killing It on Broadway is proud to support A-STEP, artists striving to end poverty. This organization was started by our friend Mary Mitchell Campbell, musical director of Broadway and beyond, who also wrote our theme song,
As we all know, the arts are in a challenging time right now in the U.S., and A-STEP has been doing innovative things during this pandemic, including feeding thousands of families, as well as bringing the arts to children. If you are able, please go to astep.org to make a contribution to the Arts Resilience Fund so they can keep killing it by bringing smiles to the faces of children everywhere.
That's astep.org. Thanks, killers.
I mean, that is just, you know, he knew there was something.
He's
there.
Not all yeah. together.
So photographer and Lennon fan Paul Goresh took a photo of Lennon signing Chapman's album. In a later interview, Chapman said that he tried to get Goresh to stay and that he asked another Lennon fan who was lingering at the building's entrance to go out with him that night. He suggested that if the girl had accepted his invitation or Goresh had stayed, he would not have murdered Lennon that evening. But he probably would have tried another day.
Idiot. I hate that, by the way. I hate a qualifier.
Am I the idiot? Who's the idiot?
No. Okay. Chapman. Can you imagine? Oh, you know, if only that girl had stayed. Mm-hmm. If only Goresh had stayed. Can you? Are you stupid? I hate it. I'm sorry. This is where I get, Jen knows. I get heated.
You stupid.
Julia, it's my favorite thing. I think the killers know now. It is my favorite thing when Miss Boss needs a Fig Newton and a nap. She gets really cranky. She needs her heads on the desk. It's going to be okay.
Yeah. I'm hangry, and I'm also pissed off at Chapman because don't you say that out loud. I'm now going to say that I wouldn't have killed him if these two people had done different things. Fuck you, bro. All right. Sorry.
That's all right.
It's all right. Work it in.
No, it's good. I'm just going to, you know what I'm going to do, guys? I'm going to dim the lights.
Dim it.
I'm going to dim the lights.
Yeah, dim it. Damn it.
Okay.
Night.
I'm going to dim the lights. Now, the Lennon spent several hours. Hours? How am I doing? The sure. Leonard spent several. The Leonard. How am I doing? You guys?
That's great. That's okay. Great.
Oh, well, I feel good about it.
I love it.
All right. The Lennon spent several hours at the Record Plant studio before returning to the Dakota at approximately 10:50 p.m. Lennon had decided against dining out so he could be home in time to say goodnight to his son before going on to the Stage Deli restaurant with Ono. The Lennons exited their limousine on 72nd Street instead of driving into the more secure courtyard of the Dakota. The Dakota doorman, Jose Perdomo, and a nearby taxi driver saw Chapman standing in the shadows by the archway. The Lennons passed Chapman and walked toward the archway entrance of the building. As Ono passed by, Chapman nodded at her. As Lennon passed by, he glanced briefly at Chapman, appearing to recognize him from earlier. Seconds later, Chapman withdrew a Charter Arms 38 caliber revolver that he had hidden in his coat pocket, aimed at the center of Lennon's back, and quickly fired 5 hollow point bullets at him from a distance of about 9 or 10 feet.
So we've discussed hollow point bullets before on this show, but those hollow point bullets are the ones that do the most damage. So, you know, it's just... Even thinking about it right now, which I always see these things as we discuss these stories, and I think to myself just how close he was and how much damage this did. So,
and I wonder if the hollow point bullets were something that he specifically requested from whoever it was in Atlanta who provided him with.
I'll bet you they were, Julia.
Or if that was what was available at the ammo. Secret place. I don't know.
No, I think he knew. I think that he knew, you know, what from having worked security or having read enough books that those are the ones that do the most damage. And to be someone with that much anger and rage and hate, obviously you said before, not well, this is not a well person, but you know, that is a premeditation that is really disgusting, because those hollow point bullets are sickening. And so at the time, you know, one of the bullets missed Lennon and it struck a window of the Dakota building. And the other four of them, they hit Lennon in the back and shoulder. It punctured his left lung and his left subclavian artery. So he was bleeding out profusely from external wounds and from his mouth. He staggered up 5 steps to the security/reception area where he said, "I'm shot. I'm shot." So then he falls to the floor and scattering all the cassettes that he'd been carrying. And Perdomo ran inside and told concierge worker Jay Hastings that the attacker had dropped his gun on the pavement. Hastings first started to make a tourniquet, but upon ripping open Lennon's bloodstained shirt and realizing the severity of the musician's multiple injuries, he covered Lennon's chest with his uniform jacket, removed his blood-covered glasses, and then summoned the police. So Chapman then removes his coat and hat in preparation for the arrival of police. Thank goodness, to show that he was not carrying any concealed weapons, and he remained standing on West 72nd Street. And Perdomo shouted at Chapman, "Do you know what you've done?" To which Chapman calmly replied, quote, "Yes, I just shot John Lennon." Now, officers Stephen Spiro and Peter Cullen were the first policemen to arrive at the scene. They were at 72nd Street and Broadway when they heard a report of shots fired at the Dakota. The officers, they arrived around 2 minutes later and found Chapman standing very, very calmly on West 72nd Street. They reported that Chapman had dropped the revolver to the ground and was holding a paperback book. You guessed it, J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye. Later, he claimed, quote, "If you were able to view the actual copy of The Catcher in the Rye that was taken from me on the night of December 8th, you would find in it the handwritten words, quote, 'This is my statement.'" They immediately put Chapman in handcuffs and placed him in the back seat of the squad car, where Chapman made no attempt to flee or resist arrest. Ugh, this guy who just as calm, you know, did this thing, has thought about it for so long. I would say if he at least had the premeditation to do it in October, which is 3 months beforehand, he's been thinking about this for a long time.
But here's the thing. If you're not caught, then you're not famous with your name.
You're good to know, Julia. Good to fugitive, know.
But you're not this person who did this thing. Mm-hmm. And while I do not think he was altogether by a long shot, I don't think there was a part of him that did not understand the, not just the severity of what he was doing in terms of taking a life, but the severity of what he was doing in terms of taking this person's life.
This particular person,
and
yes.
How famous that would make him.
Yeah,
not
I mean,
that he did it for fame, but I think it is woven into the fabric of someone who obsesses about celebrities in a good or bad way.
But let's just say this, the way he speaks about it after the fact, right? The afterthoughts are very much like an intelligent human being saying, "I knew that this was going to happen." There's not a lack of intelligence here.
No. Nope.
So that's kind of the thing that blows my mind. And we've discussed so many cases like this with so many sociopaths who are like this, that it is not a surprise that he would say things like, "If you were to read what I wrote in this book, if this person were to have stayed a little bit longer." I mean, this is like, you know, really grandiose thing about this guy that's just awful.
And it is sad to think of, like, as in so many things in life, in the world, if John and Yoko had not decided to go home after they were in the studio, if John and Yoko, I seem to remember, I might be wrong, but I seem to remember knowing this, that there was actually something, the reason they didn't drive into the Dakota is because there was some sort of a construction thing in the way.
Mm.
It wasn't a big deal, but it was. They were like, "Oh, we'll just get out here." If you've ever been to the Dakota, it's not a long walk from the curb into the inside of the building. Mm-hmm. It's not like miles and miles.
Right.
It's just a wee bit of a driveway. So for them to be like, "Yeah, we'll just walk."
And you know what? I'm sure they've done it several times. You know, I'm sure this was like a normal thing for them. So now, in addition, all this first stuff happens with this first group of cops. Now, there's a second team who arrives. Their names are Herb Frauenberger and partner Tony Palma. So they arrived a few minutes later, and They're the ones who found John Lennon lying face down on the floor of the reception area of the Dakota, blood pouring from his mouth and his clothing already soaked with it. With Hastings attending to him and now realizing the extent of Lennon's injuries, the policemen decided not to wait for an ambulance, and they immediately carried Lennon into the squad car. So he was rushed to Roosevelt Hospital on West 59th Street. Officer James Moran said they placed Lennon in the back seat, and reportedly Moran asked, quote, "Are you John Lennon?" To which Lennon nodded and replied, "Yes." Oh, Julia says no.
I know it is a different story.
Well,
I
it says, according to another account by Officer Bill Gamble, Lennon nodded slightly, tried to speak, but couldn't make any sound and lost consciousness shortly thereafter.
And I know yet a different tale.
What is you it? Must but tell it.
It's all very close to each other. Who knows? Somewhere in the middle lies the truth, was that he asked who he was in that kind of way that you ask someone who's in some sort of shock, like, do you know who the president is? Do you know what time it is? Like all that sort of... And that John's last word was, yeah.
Mm.
Like he said, I mean, obviously they knew it was John Lennon. It wasn't, but he said, do you know who you are? And he said, yeah, which is terribly poetic and was certainly included in the flop musical that I was a part of that we can talk about later. But if you want to keep telling the tale, go ahead.
Okay. So a few minutes before 11 p.m., Moran arrived at Roosevelt Hospital with Lennon in his squad car. Moran was carrying Lennon on his back and onto a gurney, demanding a doctor for a multiple gunshot wound victim. When Lennon was brought in, he was not breathing and had no pulse. Three doctors, a nurse, and two or three other medical attendants worked on Lennon for 10 to 20 minutes in an attempt to resuscitate him. As a last resort, the doctors cut open his chest and attempted manual heart massage to restore circulation, but they quickly discovered that the damage to the blood vessels above and around his heart from the multiple bullet wounds was too great. Three of the four bullets that struck Lennon's back passed completely through his body and out of his chest, while the fourth lodged itself in his aorta behind his heart. One of the exiting bullets from his chest hit and became lodged in his upper left arm. Several of the wounds could have been fatal by themselves because each bullet had ruptured vital arteries around the heart.
Hollow points.
Lennon had been shot four times. Lennon had been shot four times at close range with hollow point bullets, as we've mentioned, and his affected organs, particularly his left lung and major blood vessels above his heart, were virtually destroyed upon impact. Information regarding who operated on and attempted to resuscitate Lennon has varied. Perhaps you know something about these different stories, Julia, I'm not sure. But many reports said Stefan Lin, the head of the emergency department at Roosevelt Hospital, performed Lennon's surgery. In 2005, Lin said he massaged Lennon's heart and attempted to resuscitate him for 20 minutes, that two other doctors were present, and that the three of them declared Lennon's death. Conversely, in 1990, Richard Marks, an emergency room surgeon at Roosevelt Hospital, stated he operated on Lennon, administered a massive blood transfusion, and provided heart massage to no avail. Quote, "When I realized he wasn't going to make it," said Marks, "I just sewed him back up. I felt helpless," end quote. In 2015, surgeon David Halloran disputed the accounts of both Marks and Lynn, stating that the two doctors, quote, "didn't do anything," end quote. Halloran also stated that he did not realize whom he was operating on initially and that Lynn only came to assist him when he heard that it was Lennon. At the time, Halloran was a third-year general surgery resident at Roosevelt Hospital. That's weird.
I know.
I do not know what that shenanigan is all about. I don't know.
I don't like it.
I recall Richard Marks' name, probably because it's also the name of the pop star Richard Marks, and it stuck with me. But
and wherever you go, whatever you do,
I will be right there waiting.
And
for
I will
you.
Be right there waiting for you as well. Also, indeed. Yeah.
Well, thank you, ladies, for waiting for me because now we're going to get to a very sad moment for the world when Lennon was pronounced dead on arrival at 11:15 p.m. But the time of 11:07 has also been reported, FYI. Witnesses noticed that the Beatles' song All My Loving came over the hospital's sound system at the moment Lennon was pronounced dead. His body was then taken to the city morgue at 520 First Avenue for an autopsy. The cause of death was reported on his death certificate as hypovolemic shock caused by the loss of more than 80% of blood volume due to multiple through-and-through gunshot wounds to the left shoulder and left chest, resulting in damage to the left lung, the left subclavian artery, and both the aorta and aortic arch. And that was hollow point bullets, the loss of blood. I mean, we went through this with the Selena case. It's just too much. And she just had one gunshot wound. Now, according to the report, even with prompt medical treatment, no person could have lived for more than a few minutes with multiple bullet wounds affecting all of the major arteries and veins around the heart. Lynn informed Ono of her husband's death. According to Lynn, she started sobbing. And I'm just going to tell you her words with no dramatic accoutrement, but her words were, "Oh, no, 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 tell me it's not true." He said that Ono then laid down and began hitting her head against the floor, but calmed down when a nurse gave Lennon's wedding ring to her. His account is disputed by two of the nurses who were there. Can we talk about that for a second, you guys? It's clearly not the same thing as Mark David Chapman, but I guess when it's someone so famous, well, when it's anybody, you can have different accountings, right? Because it's such an emotional charged response. But especially when it's someone famous, everyone has a different recollection. And well, there's part of me that wonders, do they want a piece of it somehow?
Well, that's in the same way, in a obviously very different situation, but in the same way that I know I saw John and Yoko walking once in the park, and I'm also pretty sure that I made up as a 10-year-old the story of John petting my dog.
I'm glad you brought it up because it helps my A, understanding of it, and B, my empathy of it, of this very, I guess, human response. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sure. I think
there's a very where were you when moment thing happening here. And like,
I mean, even with the three doctors.
And everybody's going to have their own version of what happened and what sticks out.
And
we
also have no idea, frankly. There is this moment in time. There is the death of this icon that is happening in front of these human beings. We also do not know the history of these human beings.
We don't know
what their situations are with one another. We don't know which one was mad because the other one did a different surgery 3 weeks earlier that did the click, click, click. Like, we don't know.
Yeah.
And nothing is as simple as this is what happened in that moment. There are always extraneous.
What did you say earlier, wisely? The truth is somewhere in the middle.
The truth lies somewhere in the middle.
It's an amalgam, probably.
Yeah.
Right. It's always like there's his story, there's her story, then there's the truth. Now I'm going to move us forward here on the day following the murder. So Lennon's Beatle bandmate, George Harrison, he issued a prepared statement for the press, which said, quote, "After all we went through together, I had and still have a great love and respect for him. I am shocked and stunned. To rob a life is the ultimate robbery in life. The perpetual encroachment on other people's space is taken to the limit with the use of a gun. It is an outrage that people can take other people's lives when they obviously haven't got their own lives in order," end quote. Harrison later privately told friends, quote, "I just wanted to be in a band. Here we are 20 years later and some whack job has shot my mate. I just wanted to play guitar in a band," end quote. And then we move to Mr. Paul McCartney, who's Lennon's former writing partner, and he was leaving an Oxford Street recording studio when reporters came upon him and asked him for his reaction. He responded, quote, "Drag, isn't it?" So when publicized, the response was very criticized, very widely. And even McCartney himself regretted the seemingly callous remark and later said that he'd intended no disrespect and simply was unable to articulate his feelings given the shock and sadness he felt over Lennon's murder. Which I believe that because, you know, in moments when like somebody's coming up upon you and you're like,
you're reading the print. You know what I mean? Like someone has printed that he said drag, isn't it? And you can say drag, isn't it, about 15 different ways.
Of course. Yeah. It's how we write text messages these days. Yeah. Hashtag awful. So Lennon's murder, it triggered this outpouring of grief around the world on an unprecedented scale. And his remains were cremated at Ferncliff Cemetery in Hartsdale, Westchester County, New York. No funeral was held. Now, Ono sent word to the chanting crowds outside of the Dakota that their singing had kept her awake, and she asked that they reconvene at the Central Park band shell the following Sunday for 10 minutes of silent prayer. Oh, Julia's pointing at herself because on the 14th of December, 1980, millions of people around the world responded to Ono's request to pause for 10 minutes of silence to remember Lennon. Were you there?
I was there.
Girl.
I was absolutely there. I went to the Dakota first. Like, I don't recall if it was the next day or the day after, but I was, I can't do math. 11. I was about to be 12. Okay. 11, about to be 12. And I remember going down and there were people, you know, on both sides. If, for those of you who don't know 72nd Street, which is the street that the Dakota is on, it's a very wide, it's like a four-lane street, basically two in each direction. And there were people on the Dakota side of the street and across the street, teams of people. And I remember feeling like kind of small and a little overwhelmed by the amount of people. But regardless of that, some friends of mine and I, we went to the vigil at the Bandshell in Central Park. And one of the things I so specifically remember was that one of the girls that came with, she was a very chatty Kathy. She just liked to talk. And I remember thinking, because a 10 minutes of silence is a very long time. That is a very long time. Like nowadays at a sports event or at an awards ceremony or at anything where they ask us all to take a moment of silence, it's like, at best, it's 15 seconds at best.
Yeah.
10 minutes. And I remember thinking, A, she has never stopped talking for this long. And she did. She absolutely did. But B, I remember as a child of New York and knowing what this city sounded like, I couldn't hear, and it was silent except for the news helicopters overhead.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because 30,000 people gathered in Liverpool, which is Lennon's hometown. Mm-hmm. And then, but the largest group was in Manhattan, which was over 225,000 people were there. So that's again, 10 minutes of silence, and yeah, every radio station in New York City went off the air.
Yes.
So it's a huge thing. The judge ordered psychiatric treatment for Chapman during his incarceration and sentenced him to 20 years to life, which is 5 years less than the maximum sentence of 25 years to life. And in 1981, Chapman was imprisoned at Attica Correctional Facility outside of Buffalo, New York. He fasted for 26 days in February of 1982, so the New York State Supreme Court authorized the state to force feed him. And the Central New York Psychiatric Center director, Martin Von Holden, said that Chapman refused to eat with other inmates but agreed to take liquid nutrients. Now, he was confined to a special handling unit for violent and at-risk prisoners, in part due to concern that he might be harmed by Lennon's fans in the general population. Now, he told a parole board in 2004 what he would do if paroled. Quote, "I would immediately try to find a job. And I really want to go from place to place, at least in the state, church to church, and tell people what happened to me and point them to the way to Christ." End quote. Now, he also said that he thought he could find work as a farmhand or return to his previous trade as a printer. Chapman first became eligible for parole in the year 2000 after serving 18 years in prison. Now, under New York state law, he is required to have a parole hearing every 2 years from that year beyond. Since that time, a three-member board has denied Chapman parole 11 times. And before Chapman's first parole hearing, Yoko Ono sent a letter to the board requesting that he not be released from prison. In addition, New York State Senator Michael Nozzolio, chairman of the Senate Crime Victims Crime and Correction Committee, wrote to parole board chairman Breonne Travis saying, quote, "It is the responsibility of the New York State Parole Board to ensure that public safety is protected from the release of dangerous criminals like Chapman." Now, there was a parole hearing in 2020, denied, and Chapman's 12th parole hearing is scheduled for August of 2022. I venture to say that will be denied as well.
So, Julia, is there anything you wanted to add? You mentioned you sort of had your hand up about the night before. What was that about?
Well, the night that he was killed, here's what my 11-year-old self remembers. So I grew up, I don't live there anymore, but I grew up on West 82nd Street between Amsterdam and Columbus, which is where the 20th Precinct police station is. And I remember that night being outside on the sidewalk with my dad coming from Amsterdam Avenue, and the precinct is closer to Columbus, and seeing lights in front of the precinct. And wondering, we were like, oh, what's that? But we didn't go down. We just went into our building. Oh. And that was that. And it's where they brought Chapman.
Oh my goodness.
And then when I woke up in the morning, my mom told me that John had died.
Oh,
And because I had been named for his song and all of that, like he was such, the Beatles and John and all of that were such a part of my, but that was just my little sort of tidbit about that night. I don't know why my dad and I would have been out at 11 o'clock at night unless we had gone to like walk the dog together or something. That was very possible. But I don't remember there being commotion. I just remember seeing all these bright lights right down where we knew the entrance to the police precinct was.
It's so wild to think of after the fact, I'm sure. Yeah.
This is why I love not only talking with a local, but, you know, you're our friend and this beloved member of our Broadway community who grew up just mere blocks from where this happened. You and I are so close in age, Julia, and I have to tell you ladies this, but I was a huge Beatles fan. I was 10 years old when this happened, and I had just discovered them because there was a TV movie that came out that year called The Birth of the Beatles. And at 10 years old, I watched it, and then I discovered, wait a minute, there really is a group named The Beatles? What? And I took all of my allowance money and bought every album that my allowance could afford. And I would listen to it every day after school. I had every song memorized by heart. I used to wear paraphernalia to school. And I will say, the day he died, I spread out all my paraphernalia on my bed and just, you know, cried my eyes out. And I went down to my piano and I wrote him a song. And the title's so terrible, but it was called The One and Only John. And I told these two girls who were older than me at school, and they asked me to play it really sweetly. And then they made fun of me. It was so painful.
I don't know where those bitches are right now, but they can kiss my ass.
And
there.
Then Mean Girls was written. No, I do have to say I've been a massive Beatles fan since I was 3 or 4. My dad introduced me to the Beatles, as well as like Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Stills, Nash. But I became quite obsessed with the death of John Lennon. And one of my favorite musicians, Elton John, wrote a song for the death of John Lennon called Empty Garden, Hey, Hey, Johnny.
Fantastic
song. One of my favorite songs.
Me too.
Ever.
I mean, it's not as good as The One and Only John, but that's okay.
Agreed. Mm-hmm. This is like minus the song that you wrote for,
you know,
for John.
Jen, comparison is the thief of joy.
It's the thief of joy.
I mean,
for God's
I know,
sake.
But I just, it's the truth. And I'm a
But if you all listen, if you all look at the Saturday Night Live 1982 or 83, I can't remember which year, I think 82, live performance of Elton John singing Empty Garden, it's just something that I have been obsessed with for a very long time. And you know, Elton John also changed the lyrics to Candle in the Wind for Princess Diana. And
well,
that was
also
another...
one of the last public performances John gave was he guested in with Elton John at the Garden, and they sang Whatever Gets You Through the Night.
Oh, and you know, it's you think of these tragedies, right? The world, it's this weird juxtaposition because the world wouldn't be the same without them. And the world was changed because of them, yet you never wanted them to happen. And that's the thing we discussed about Selena. It's the thing that I also think about with Princess Diana. It's these things of these huge, monumentally famous world figures. And John being the type of person who has quoted himself as being like, look, I've been an asshole in the past. I've had issues with women. I have hit women. But then I met Yoko Ono and the two of us went on a huge journey together. And then I wrote the song, Believe, or it was on the Sgt. Pepper, about the fact that he has been a changed man and how could I possibly ever take out my aggressions that I have against women. And like, you know, just somebody who was always very open, very, very much like practice what he preached. You know, the sit-ins that he had in his apartment and all of these things that he did for the betterment of the human race. And also just being so visible and human and available to his fans. These are things that just don't exist today. You cannot get past security to save your life. You cannot, you know, show up to somebody's building without security.
No.
You know, like these are things
and
that just would
part
never
of that,
happen.
Frankly, is because of what happened to
yes,
John.
Yes, and what you and know, what has happened to several other, you know, pop stars, movie stars.
Julia. Thank you so much for being here. I truly, when we were coming up with this, last August, I was like, we have to ask Julia to do this case with us. And you said yes, and we can't thank you enough.
It's my pleasure.
It's because
always.
She's a national treasure.
She is a national treasure. She is. We love you. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye, Julia.
Bye.
Jess, we love her. We love her so much.
You know what? there are things that I need to always say about Julia Murney, and I could say them forever and ever, but number one, I'm her biggest fan. Number two, I'm also her biggest fan. Number three, I will always talk to her through a stanchion, and I love her to pieces, and she knows it. And if you all don't know it, now you know it, and killers, we find you to be also the loves of our lives, even if it's through a stanchion. So thank you very much for listening, and until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content. And follow us on Instagram at Killing It On Broadway and Twitter at Killing It On B-Way.
Subscribe to us for free wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It On Broadway is a production of Killing It On Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.